It is Saturday, August 27th, 2011. We are broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is Public Radio KUSP. Join the car guys, click and clack, to Tappet Brothers for their advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Car Talk every Sunday at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support for businesses, tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializes in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Miles Elam. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. During the show, I'll be covering geek news and inviting you to join me by phone with questions and comments about technology. The phone numbers are 800-655-5877. Once again, this is Miles Elam. In the air room with me are merely listeners rather than other geeks. Although there is a geek standing right next to me right now, but he's busy with other things. Say hi, Charlie. So what I will start off with is a little bit of news regarding geek and law. This is having to do with a federal appeals court, which has stated that a state law, in this case, the state being Massachusetts, against citizens taking pictures or videotaping or otherwise recording police officers during their activities, that law is unconstitutional. This was brought up by a Boston lawyer who was actually in the Boston Commons, and he was arrested because of a wiretapping law. The wiretapping law is that people have to have consent about being recorded. And the police officers have been, many police officers around the country have been using this as a method to basically say that when people are recording them during their duty, it is impinging, causing a problem for them doing their job. And at the same time, this court was saying that, no, not only should the First Amendment apply to the ability to say things that you want to say and to assemble with people to gather information, it is also a guarantee about the availability of information. In other words, that you have to be able to record in order to have that information available to disseminate to other people. So this is a curious back and forth, and it's still not a decided question. This is where the prevalence of iPhones and other camera phones, where you really are blurring that line between who is a photojournalist and who is just someone who happened to be at the place at the right time taking photo or video of a notable event. I'm sure we've all seen on CNN or any of the other news stations where someone has posted to YouTube a particular video that they're rebroadcasting, or someone has licensed some video from someone who was on the scene. And we're going to see more and more of that as time goes on. So that line, not to say that journalists and the journalism profession have a deficiency in some way, they don't. It's just that that line of where the journalist ends and where the blogger begins is becoming a bit more blurred. And as I said, this is not a decided case. There is a woman by the name of Tiawanda Moore, who is from Chicago, and she was recording on her recording device a conversation with a police officer that she has stated sexually assaulted her. However, she was saying that she was doing this because the Internal Affairs was telling her not to file a complaint, and there's some back and forth about this, but the point being that by recording this conversation without the knowledge of the police officer, even though it was done in a public place, she faces 15 years in prison. So this raises that question of who watches the watchers, I guess. But I'm not trying to get into, a conspiracy mode or a paranoia mode. It's just talking about the effect of technology on how we are able to perceive things. And also for it has already become a defense for police officers, for example, the dashboard cam, to know that someone that the police officer was doing everything they were supposed to be doing correctly. And it has been a defense for them in court. And so that question is, does it go both ways? And it's something we need to work out in the next few years. And speaking of tech and having to do policing, there is an article by Tech World that is talking about the fact that social media could actually have undercover police officer assignments go the way of the dodo. The social media outlets like Facebook or MySpace or Google Plus now are incorporating technologies such as face recognition, and you have the associations with graph theory from one user to another. And so you have this issue of if a officer has some information up on Facebook, even if they themselves don't have a Facebook account, someone may take a picture of them and tag them by their name. It means that someone making a search for a person, or if they put their picture up on that site, when that officer is undercover, it may tag them and therefore out them in these very hostile situations. And so the biometrics is really changing the landscape. And I think that we are going to be seeing changes in the next 20 or 30 years that are going to dramatically change the landscape that you and I are used to. Those shows like Law and Order are going to start having to incorporate different plot lines, as it were. And here, speaking of social media, a judge has chosen to block a law in Missouri that has banned private messages between teachers and students, or teachers and kids, anyone who's under the age of 18. The law was intended to curtail any illicit romances that may be going on, some untoward relationships. At the same time, it also blocked anything that wouldn't be untoward, something that would be acceptable. For example, a teacher saying, I like the comment that you made today in class. You should do that more often. If a teacher is saying, hey, you missed this information when you were out sick, you should read up on this. Here's your assignment. These are avenues that would be absolutely legitimate, and there are equivalent avenues in real life. When I say real life, I mean, for example, sending an assignment home with a parent or another student to be able to keep the child who's been out of school up to date with the latest lessons. And then, of course, there's always the phone, which has always been an avenue for people to contact one another. Well, this judge has stated that that law is overbroad. And in fact, one of the critiques of this law has been that if a teacher is also a parent, that parent would not be able to communicate with their child over Facebook. In other words, these unintended consequences, which I think the people who made the law had an honest reason for doing so. However, as the technology goes, and it's, as I've been talking about so far this show, as the technology mutates, as it were, as it finds itself in new areas that we hadn't considered yet, as it combines with other technologies that we hadn't combined it with before, we find that the laws that target specific things like blocking social networking such as Facebook for teachers versus students is going to have a backscatter effect where you're getting unintended consequences that you didn't see ahead of time, and you're curtailing some legitimate uses that would be natural, as it were, with the available tools that we have for communication. Which then brings me to my next story. We have talked before about people being brought up on charges. For example, when actually, before I get into this show, I do want to have some comment from the audience. If you are interested in these topics, or if you have any questions with regard to tech support, to programming, to alternative operating systems like Linux or BSD, or if you need some help with your Mac or PC, please give us a call here. The number here locally is area code 831-476-2800, or toll free at 800-655-5877. So getting back to the story about IP addresses, someone comes from the Electronic Freedom Foundation. We have talked before on the show about how the Recording Industry Association of America, the Motion Picture Association of America, the RIAA and MPAA, respectively, would try to track down individuals that were using peer-to-peer software. And one of the ways that they would do this is they'd track the user down by their IP address, an IP address being this 32-bit number that essentially it's a number somewhere between 4 digits long and 12 digits long. Anytime you see something like 192.168.0.1, you know, on your computer, that type of thing comes up. That's an IP address. It's roughly the equivalent of a phone number for your computer so that you can talk to other computers that have their own IP address or internet phone number. And when you connect up to your ISP, you are given one of these IP addresses, one of these internet phone numbers, if you will. And so many companies and many organizations have been using these to try to track down users and law enforcement agencies as well. But there's been some criticism of this because an IP address can change between users, some ISP customers. If you turn off your computer and turn it back on again a day later, you may find you have a different IP address to work with. And in fact, there is a technology known as Tor that we have talked about on the show a couple of times before, which will allow a user to use a browser. Something's called the Tor browser. There's also plugins for various browsers, like for Firefox, the Tor plugin. And what it does is it proxies, or in other words, sends your communication to a website through multiple different machines. And people can volunteer to be part of the Tor network. In other words, people will connect to your machine and then tell you, but I want to go to this other place. And you connect to another proxy and they say, okay, but I really want to go to this other website. And through a series of intermediaries, you go to the final website, and the original website has no idea by IP address who you are. The only IP address they would have is the last proxy in the chain. And those last proxies are referred to as an exit node, a Tor exit node. And when Immigration and Customs Enforcement took out a search warrant on the home of a Nolan King and seized six computer hard drives in connection with a criminal investigation, and they were looking up various sundries. I believe in this case, it had to do with child pornography. But at the same time, he had nothing to do with it. He had this proxy running that allows people to route through, and he happened to just be what's called an exit node, the last step in that chain. And he had no idea what the traffic was going to be like, and the person, coming out had, the computer coming connecting to him didn't really know who he was. They were just saying, hey, I wanted to get this connection out. And that raises some real difficulties, both for the ethics of having an exit node, although people have been arguing quite a lot that there is too much tracking going on. We have a lot of callers coming in on a regular basis saying they don't want to be tracked. How can I get rid of these cookies? Last week we talked about these types of cookies that you can't really delete, really hard to get around. And so when people come up with these technologies to make you more anonymous online, that shouldn't really come as a surprise. There are a lot of people out there that have a demand for that. And not necessarily for illegal purposes, just because they don't want to be tracked. At the same time, it does make someone who is doing illegal activities harder to track. So where do we find this? Where do we find that middle ground? Where do we find that compromise? Or should we be compromising in either direction? That's the conversation that we need to be having. Because this is only going to become more difficult, as I said, because as technology becomes more pervasive in our life and becomes more varied, it's going to have a lot of these impacts that no one really foresaw, or very few people foresaw. And so the Electronic Freedom Foundation, the EFF, generally takes the stance of more freedom for the individual is better, and if it's harder for law enforcement, then that's just how it's going to have to be. Within a reasonable standard. And they are the equivalent of the ACLU for the internet. Think of like the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment, but I guess in this case also for an anonymity, the Fifth Amendment, but for the online world specifically. And they're not alone with this notion of looking for IP addresses, and they're not just, for example, protecting child pornographers. I don't want to leave that impression with listeners. One of the other aspects to that would be them taking a look at manufacturers that may be helping repressive governments. For example, in this case, they have lodged a complaint against the corporation Cisco. For those of you who are not familiar with Cisco, if you are using the internet, you are going through a Cisco router at some point. If you have a Linksys router in your home, you're already using Cisco hardware. But chances are, if you're going from one computer to another, if you're going to a computer that's in a different country, somewhere along the line, you are going through a router or some proxy or something, some piece of hardware that is either manufactured or designed by Cisco systems. I mean, they are the backbone of the internet. You take Cisco away, the internet doesn't work anymore. At the same time, we've also talked about on the show what's been known as the Great Internet Firewall of China. Many people have heard about this, where China has put up policies that says that their citizens cannot look up certain topics. They've pressured organizations like Google and Bing, Microsoft's Bing, to change their search results so that it comes up with something different than what we would expect in the rest of the world. For example, if we were to put in a search for Tiananmen Square, here in the U.S., we get a lot of the stories that we're familiar with the Tiananmen Square demonstrations and subsequent government crackdown. On the other hand, if you do a search for Tiananmen Square while you were in China, you will see, for example, pictures of Tiananmen Square, its long history, cultural events that will go on with it. But you don't see anything having to do with the civil unrest related to Tiananmen Square. And that, in some part, has to do with the technologies that Cisco Systems has integrated into their systems and has sold to the Chinese government. Now, the question that the Electronic Freedom Foundation has is, would they then be liable for things like the Torture Victim Protection Act of 1991? That the idea is that you are not going to aid foreign nations in the torture and abuse of their citizens through the course of you selling them products. And this specifically comes in the case of these names that unfortunately I'm going to mangle because I do not speak Chinese, but Du Daobin, Zhao Xianxi, and Liu Xiaoban are, along with 10 unnamed John Doe plaintiffs, are people who have been harassed by the Chinese government because of the ability of the Chinese government to track them down through the firewall technologies and the routing technologies that made available and have by Cisco, and have had Cisco consultants helping them implement them and train them in how to maintain them and make them better. So they are these questions that are open for us about what is acceptable use of technology and what isn't. And I hope that we have more of these conversations in our public sphere, as opposed to some things that may not be as relevant. Because the less conversations we have about these, the more we're going to see laws that will have these unintended consequences, or that will miss out on some important areas that we may find dear, that if we put just a little bit of thought to them, we would have some idea about, you know, how would we address them. So we are coming up on the middle of the show, and as such, I think I'll play a little bit of the theme music again to let you know that you are listening to Geek Speak on KUSP. And Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Dr. Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in handcrafted dentistry from start to finish using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment crowns and veneers. Information at 423-2447. You are listening to KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio. And we have a phone call coming in from Santa Cruz. We're listening to Justin from Salinas. Hello,
hey,
Justin.
How are you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I really like your topic. One of the things that I had a question on, I wonder if you can clarify, is I know that I know kind of the how you can mask your IP address, but I don't normally go through that hassle. There's another thing called the MAC address, and can you talk about, are those two related? And I know that I know some programs that use the internet you disregard my IP address and look to the MAC address and kind of block what I'm doing. But how are those related, and is there a way to mask it?
That's a great question, and I guess I'll take that one. I'll go a little technical on this one, and hopefully folks will be able to follow along. A MAC address is something that you usually associate with a network card. Every network card, in other words, what you connect to your DSL modem, like an Ethernet connection, or, for example, your wireless connection to your coffee shop or your home router, they each have their own unique MAC address. There's only one for every machine out there, unless someone is doing something, you know, kind of sneaky. And so when you buy a new computer, that computer has a MAC address that does not exist on any other computer anywhere else in the world. And what that aids in doing is, if you are in a local area network, a LAN, you are able to connect these different computers up, and that's, for example, a switch or a router that you are connected to, you can, that is the mechanism that the router can tell, like, oh, this person's connected to port number one, this one's connected to port number two, this one's connected to port number three. And I guess the best way to describe it, in terms of bad metaphors anyway, would be it's your computer's social security number. And your social security number never changes. It's always the same for that person, for, you know, for the lifetime of that computer or that network interface for its lifetime, as opposed to an IP address, which is a phone number, which can change and does change when you move your laptop from your home to the coffee shop to your family's house, that type of thing. And how they work together is that router or switch will have what's known as an ARP table, an address resolution protocol table. And what that does is says this MAC address or social security number applies to this phone number or IP address. And so that's how you are actually able to communicate with one computer to another on a local area network. And so if someone wants to do something like content filtering, like there are companies that have web filters. I'm sure people have come across this before. You try to put in some website that you don't want to, that the company doesn't want you to be playing around with. They don't want you using viewing ESPN during company hours, that type of thing. And you'll get a block message saying this is not allowed on the company network or something similar. Right. And that is done through usually a MAC address, or it can be through a local IP address, but many times done through a MAC address just because it's faster to deal with. And it's easier to resolve a particular user and a particular computer if the IP addresses are changing in a DHCP environment. DHCP being that thing that gives out the IP addresses.
So can I have a follow-up? So the MAC address is kind of my...
I'm sorry, is there any way that I can get you to speak up? You're a little quiet.
I had a follow-up question. As far as so the MAC address is like my social security card of my computer, but if I don't use the onboard hardware and I sort of use a separate way to connect to the internet, is it going to read that separate network card, social security card, or is it still going to know that it's my computer all the time?
No, it's by the network interface. So if you put in a separate network card, you will have a different MAC address if you're connecting through that card. So the reason why I said it's by computer is it's de facto true, but it's not technically true. In other words, nowadays the network card or the Ethernet adapter, which would be like a gigabit Ethernet adapter or 100 megabit, most of the time they're a gigabit now. So whenever you see a computer and it says it has that's gigabit Ethernet, that is actually integrated into the motherboard itself. And so it really does, you know, travel with the computer. You take away that motherboard, you basically have a new computer in a lot of senses. And so if you put in a separate network card and then you connect up your network to that other network card, then yes, you will have a different MAC address. A very important point, though, to note is that, for example, Google.com, when you're making searches, cannot see your MAC address. A MAC address is only visible on a local network segment. In other words, the MAC address would only be visible to your local home router or to the local coffee shop router or switch. It would not be visible to a machine on a separate network, which is basically every website that's out there.
Oh, okay. Well, I have this program installed. It's actually a chat client. And I think, is it because that I have it installed that it knows that it's the same computer, whether or not I use a different IP address?
But the chat client, it's not so much the fact that it's talking to a remote resource about your MAC address. It's actually asking your computer, hey, what's the MAC address? So it's something that's running on your computer, and so they would have access to that, to see that number.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so. The concern is that, you know, I don't necessarily want Amazon to know what I'm doing.
Amazon, well, okay, there's...
And companies like that online what I'm doing.
Right. To say don't want them to know what you're doing is a little... If you're talking about tracking from when you leave Amazon going someplace else, right. Your MAC address actually doesn't have anything to do with that. Like I said... When you're not on the same local network, in other words, Amazon is in some server that's, you know, somewhere in San Jose or in Virginia or the like, they can't see anything. So anything that leaves your house, you no longer have that MAC address. The MAC addresses that are contained are like router to router. If you talk to your own home router and then that router talks to the ISP router, the ISP router only sees your home router. And then the ISP router talks to a backbone router. In other words, the big pipe. And that backbone pipe only sees your ISP's router, that MAC address. And then,
So for instance, when the government was kind of investigating the person because of the, in relation to the child porn case, Did the MAC address come into that scenario where they will say, the MAC address, and they made that comparison, or was it just only the IP address?
It was only the IP address. They would not have access to the MAC address, especially going through a Tor network when you're going through multiple proxies. I mean, you wouldn't have the MAC address just by going through one hop, and you're going through a Tor proxy, which means you're probably going through five hops even before you really start routing out to that site, to the website.
Okay, well, thank you.
No problem. Thank you for the call. That was a great question. And our phone lines are still open. You can give us a call, 831-476-2800, or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. And moving on with a little bit of news. I talked about Cisco already. Something that I did find interesting, and I wanted to put up as a little geek bit, is how many of you out there were aware that former President James Garfield provided a new and, at the time anyway, unique proof of the Pythagorean theorem. Yeah, the Pythagorean theorem, this is the square of the hypotenuse is equal to the sum of the square of the other two sides. It's, if you've ever seen the A squared plus B squared equals C squared, you know, a right triangle. If you want to know what the longest side is, you square the other two sides, add them together, and then square the longest side and see if they equal each other. And any right triangle, this will work. And to know that a former U.S. president spent the time to play around with math enough to come up with his own proof. He wasn't the first one to come up with the proof for the Pythagorean theorem. That's obvious. That was actually a Greek by the name of Pythagoras, hence the name Pythagorean. But can you imagine today having a president who wins a Nobel Prize or this isn't quite like winning a Nobel Prize, but that advances technology and says like, oh, I found this proof to some mathematical formula, or I have discovered this new gene for, let's say someone was a president that was a doctor. And, you know, we've had a couple, and we definitely have quite a few doctors in the House and Senate that, you know, pioneered some new type of surgery or created something new. It's something that I don't know that it would even occur to us. I mean, the closest thing we've had to it that I'm aware of lately has been the Energy Secretary, Stephen Chu, who published, you know, or is a Nobel Prize winner and, you know, has published different papers even while he's had his tenure as Energy Secretary. And yet that was one of the reasons why he was appointed, was because he had this background. But just to let you know that it's not necessarily the case that the presidents are not at the forefront or at the leading edge of what puts our society forward. They're not just managers, if you will. They can actually be someone who is, you know, more technically inclined and gets down into the trenches. And I have on my list that there is another call, but I don't see it on my my board, so I'll have to go on to some other news. Speaking of presidents, I wanted to bring up... Oh, never mind, I have the phone call is back. So let's try Ida from Santa Cruz. Hello, Ida, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I went shopping to Costco the other day, and I wanted to pay with my MasterCard. However, they do not accept that, so I was compelled to fill out an application for the American Express card. My question is, on the application, they wanted my Social Security number. Am I in trouble for giving it to them?
That's a Interesting question. First off, I want to let everyone know that that's listening that I am not a lawyer. This is not legal advice. This is not a substitute for a professional consultation, as Dr. Don would say. But from what I know as a layman, the Social Security number is not required to get a credit card. However, it is common practice to ask for it. I know for just about any type of credit card application, for getting phone service, for getting internet service in a lot of cases, that many of us have, we see on the application this, you know, question for the Social Security number, and there is no technical reason per se why that company needs that information. I don't know that it's necessarily a danger to you. I don't know how. I don't know of any specific cases where there's been a lot of identity theft because someone has given out their Social Security number. But I do know of many cases where people have not wanted to give their Social Security number, and the credit card company will provide other means to fulfill the conditions of their application without supplying that Social Security number. But it's a lot more trouble, and it means that you have to contact them directly and work out any of those issues.
Okay, but thank you.
Yeah, but I don't believe that you necessarily have a problem per se putting down that Social Security number on Costco. I think people need to worry more about where they're putting in their information when they're just out and about. For example, putting in your credit card information on a site that's a bit more shady, or if you're doing banking from a coffee shop, that's probably a bigger concern, I think, in terms of security.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Take care. Thank you for calling.
Okay, bye.
And so I'm going to do another quick geek bit. This one, since we're talking about presidents, I just wanted to talk a little bit about President Woodrow Wilson. And this is a quote from him, just to let folks know he was a president in the early 20th century. And he had a comment on evolution. And people have had these arguments back and forth for many years about whether or not evolution is a belief system or whether or not it is science and what is the pros and cons of it. And I thought it would be interesting to hear the historical context. And I just have a geek interest in this. That's why I call it a geek bit. But from a president from 1912 that has this quote: "That, of course, like every other man of intelligence and education, I do believe in organic evolution. It surprises me that at this late date, such questions should be raised." It's just a curious thing to me that someone would refer to 1912 as a late date to be discussing evolution. As far as he was concerned, it was a done deal. It's a curious thing how 100 years can pass, or, you know, 99 years can pass, and this debate is still with us. On the phones, I have Bob from Aromas. Hello, Bob. You're on the air.
Okay. Hi, Miles.
Hi.
You know, I have a suggestion, and that is maybe you could have a program, or one of these times, you know, on your program, have people call in as to the likes and dislikes of some of the security, internet security programs that are out there in the malware, and what their experiences have been and what they like and don't like about them, you know. And that to me would be really helpful.
Okay. This is a fairly long topic. We also have some other shows. You could check the archives, but I'll do my best right now and try to narrow it down, because it does tend to be a pros and cons. If any listeners out there of Dr. Don will be, I'm sure, be familiar with the concept of a cost-benefit analysis with regard to your health. This very much applies with regard to any virus, any spyware, malware, prevention systems, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we've said on the show many times, many ways it's tongue-in-cheek, but in some ways we feel there's a grain of truth to this, is using a Mac is a great antivirus setup.
Right.
And whether that be because there are fewer Macs and PCs or from how it's architected or who knows whatever the reason is, for right now, even though some more malware has been showing up of late for Macs, it's on the order of like a dozen total, as opposed to a dozen show up probably every 12 to 24 hours for the Windows side or for the PC side.
Right. I was thinking along the lines of Adobe.
And so if you're talking about security systems, like what's the best way to go? I have a love-hate relationship with antivirus systems. On the one hand, I know that when people are browsing the internet at large, the general user, they're kind of necessary. They're just people go to gambling sites, people go to random sites, people click on pop-ups that come up on their browser that the only reason that that I myself would know better than to click on them is because I do web development. I know how the systems work. And so I know how to recognize some of the signs of that is not how it would have been written if someone was on the up and up. And but I can't make that expectation for the general public. And I think that's been one of the failings of the computer industry is that they have been expecting education to be the fallback mechanism. And, you know, since we've been trying education for, what is it now, 20 years? You know, 15 years now for the internet. If education worked, we'd be doing better, and we're not.
Yeah.
So I do recommend that people get antivirus systems. The reason I have a love-hate relationship with them is that, by and large, your computer will get slower, like on a Windows system. Your system will get slower if you have an antivirus system.
Right.
Computers keep getting faster, and yet we don't see a huge speed increase. Sometimes we see it going slower, and not all of that is because the software is written poorer. It's just because if there are more viruses and signatures to go through and having to do scans of systems and hard drives get bigger and the more of it you have to scan, it's going to take longer. So the fact that your system is still running relatively fast, even though we have all of these antivirus systems on there, is actually a testament to how fast the computers are getting nowadays. So what would I suggest? I don't have an easy answer other than the status quo. Get an antivirus system and make sure it's up to date. You don't have to pay for them, although I think that some of the track record of some of the pay-for antivirus systems is a little bit better. I would recommend that people stop using Internet Explorer and don't download pirated programs, because they are a very common vector for getting viruses and worms and Trojans.
On the Explorer, can I eliminate the Explorer?
Well, you Internet can't necessarily, excuse me, you can't necessarily eliminate it. Internet Explorer is a fundamental part of Windows. In other words, the email reader that you may be having that's built in from Microsoft may be using an Internet Explorer widget. The help system uses an Internet Explorer component to view the different help text. there are many different utilities out there that are using those components from Internet Explorer. But the browser itself is something that you can avoid, and that's the big blue E. Although I do have to be honest, if you are running Windows 7, you should absolutely download Internet Explorer 9. What I'm saying now does not really apply to Internet Explorer 9. Its track record has actually gotten a lot better in terms of security. But if you are on a Windows XP system or if you are on Windows 7 and you're using an older version of IE, like IE 8, I would strongly recommend you stop using them. And move to something else, like download Mozilla Firefox, Google Chrome, Opera is another browser out there. And once again, if you're on Windows 7, there's no reason why you should be using an insecure version of, or an older version of Internet Explorer.
you should absolutely be moving to Internet Explorer 9 if you want to still use Internet Explorer. Otherwise, download any of those other browsers.
Okay.
Those are some of the big items. Online games can sometimes be an issue, but mainly it's those going to the sites like online gambling or going to porn sites, adult sites. Those are ones where you're going to have sites that have a higher infection rate. The things that are more on the fringes of society that people don't want to talk about, they're going there. And so it's, you know, they're going to the places that, you know, they're being a little bit more hesitant about speaking about. And therefore, it's harder to nail down when someone's doing something bad. Offshore gambling being the same thing. It may be illegal, for example, technically in your state, but you still, excuse me, connect up to that site that's based in the Cayman Islands that doesn't really have the legal framework to try to track down criminals, even if they cared.
Mm-hmm.
So those are things you have to watch out for. Those are things you have to have some special vigilance for. And if you do take those practices, you do need to be more careful. It's just like if you were engaging in unsafe sex practices, you know, having multiple partners, we want to have protection. You want to get yourself tested. And that's where the antivirus comes in. So the more risky behavior, the more you want to protect against that.
I have a supposedly good Kaspersky internet.
Kaspersky,
anyway,
yeah.
But I've been using Malwarebytes and Super Anti-Spyware. And Malwarebytes seems to catch some things that Kaspersky doesn't. You know,
yeah, and that actually will always be the case. That's a bit more akin to the difference between a tetanus shot and a measles, mumps, rubella. they're each going to do a little bit better, but, you know, as viruses, or actually the different vaccines for, I should say, a flu virus, is that different vaccines are going to be able to target different flu types or flu signatures. And so no one is going to be able to cover all the bases. And you just have to do your best case. There's no way that's going to make you absolutely safe, unfortunately. Security doesn't work that way.
Right. there seems to be, you know, things that are just popping up all the time. And the changes are too much for anybody to keep up with.
Right. And the thing is... even though the antivirus vendors may have better perform, some may do better with other viruses than others. After a virus outbreak has already occurred, they are all pretty good about patching them up, you know, a week after the fact or 2 weeks after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
So there, the important thing with antivirus is to make sure that you have a subscription to them, and that you constantly get updates. If you have an antivirus system and you're not getting updates, like, for example, it expired last year, it's really not going to do you any much better than if you didn't have any antivirus at all.
Right.
So either have the antivirus and keep it up to date, or don't have it at all and have your system run faster. It's probably, I think, a choice to make there. Once you're going to go down that route, you might as well go all the way and get the advantages of not having antivirus without the drawbacks.
I've noticed that in my computer that, you know, with every version, there seems to be, well, in order for them to keep up, you say the information, you know, has to be, it kind of balloons, it bloats. And I've noticed, you know, there's a slowdown. And that was one of my pet peeves is that, you know, they take up so much time in running and then when they do run, you know, there's very little you can do.
Right. So. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was a great conversation to have. And once again, in the GeekSpeak archives, there are a lot of topics, a lot of conversations about antivirus that would go a lot more in-depth and give better recommendations than I have in this short period of time.
Okay.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
And I think we have time for one more call. Kirkland in Santa Cruz. Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Kirkland.
Mm-hmm. You're on the air.
I've got an Intel Mac, and it's been running really slowly until I reinstalled the OS, Snow Leopard, still running slow. What I assume that even though the disk utility didn't detect any other viruses, I should do like with a clean wipe, completely clean my hard drive. But how do I do that?
Well, I don't know that a virus would be the issue here. A lot of times when a system starts getting a little weird or starts going slowly, first instinct that people have to say is that it's a virus. In your case, wiping the operating system is a pretty definitive that you don't have a virus.
Well, I haven't done that yet.
Okay. Well, I mean, like, just reinstalling the OS. You're talking about you reinstall the OS over an existing installation? In other words, you installed it and all your same programs are still there and nothing was deleted?
Right.
Okay. Well, you're on Snow Leopard, which means that what I would suggest at this point...
But excuse me, I was on Leopard, and then I went to Snow Leopard.
Okay. And that's what caused it to run very slowly, or it's still...
No, it was running slowly in Leopard, and okay. It's running exactly the same way in Snow Leopard.
Okay. Which means that you have something installed that is some configuration that is slowing things down, and that was migrated over with the new OS. So one thing that you can try is, first, do you have backups of your system?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So you've been using Time Machine?
Right.
Okay. That's wonderful. So that means that when you do a clean wipe of the operating system, when you do a reinstall, that you can get all your data back. And that's a great place to start. And anyone who's listening, if you haven't, I'm sorry, I've totally run out of time now. Stay on the line. I will talk to you after the show to talk about this. But unfortunately, you're out of time with the show, and I need to get going.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thanks for listening. Remember, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons endeavor. Share and share alike. If you'd like to participate in the show, please feel free to do so. If you'd like to do something with our content, go ahead.